This is Learning from Genocide, a series brought to you by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. In these episodes, we will be giving a voice to just some of the incredible stories of human endurance in the face of evil. I'm Rachel Century, Head of Research for the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, and over the next few weeks, as well as talking to experts who have dedicated their lives to raising awareness, we'll also be hearing from those who have survived the Holocaust and atrocities of Cambodia, Bosnia, Rwanda, and Darfur.
It always makes me cry to talk about it, but I think for the rest of my life, it's the most important thing I've ever done, really.
Heinrich Himmler decreed that all gypsies, and I always use that term in inverted commas, should be sent to Auschwitz.
These are the first-hand stories of the people who were there and who, against all odds, survived genocide. In this episode of Learning from Genocide, we're going to look at the other groups, aside from the Jewish people, who faced the cruelty and fear of Nazi persecution and how that persecution varied from country to country, including when the Nazis marched on British soil. Dr. Jilly Carr is a senior lecturer and academic director in archaeology at the University of Cambridge's Institute of Continuing Education and a fellow of St. Catherine's College. She works in the field of conflict archaeology, POW archaeology and heritage studies, including research into the Nazi occupation of the Channel Islands, writing many books on the subject. Jilly joins us today to talk about something not always considered when World War II and Nazi occupation is discussed, the fact that Nazi boots were on British soil when the Channel Islands were invaded in 1940. But first, I asked her which groups, other than the Jewish communities of Europe, were faced with Nazi persecution.
Well, I think that's a very good question, because actually it did vary a little depending on which country we're talking about that was occupied. I think one of the most important things to realise is that the occupation of each different occupied country was slightly different. But generally speaking, we are talking about resistors or political prisoners who were persecuted, but also Jehovah's Witnesses, Freemasons and Roma, Sinti and gay people.
So what kind of persecution would these groups expect to face? And was it a gradual process?
Well, in the case studies that I'm familiar with, it was gradual. It was about different things happening at different times, different laws being passed at different times. And also, I think if, for example, we're to think about resistors, it would often be different events would happen during the war which would give resistors perhaps confidence to carry out particular acts, make them particularly angry and want to take retaliation. So we can see that some aspects of persecution or cracking down on certain groups were because of certain things that happened. But generally speaking, we just see different things happening at different times.
But can you tell us what would the situation have been on the Channel Islands?
I'm going to focus on two particular groups to tell you about, Jews and resistors, because actually in the Channel Islands, we don't see persecution of gay people. We don't see persecution of Freemasons. We don't see persecution of the mentally and physically disabled groups. And there were no Roma and Sinti in the Channel Islands to be persecuted either. So to look at those two groups, within months of the Germans arriving in the Channel Islands, they passed anti-Semitic legislation through the royal courts. And I think with the Jewish population of the Channel Islands, it's useful to draw a distinction between Jews who were British-born or had British nationality and Jews who did not, who came to the Channel Islands during the 1930s, either as refugees or as economic migrants, and sometimes both. And so because a lot of British Jews evacuated before the Germans arrived, those who were left in the islands were not British, were not protected by British nationality. And so the members of the royal court in Guernsey and Jersey, at least in Guernsey, they were under the impression that all of the British Jews had left. This is what they said afterwards, that there would be no harm in agreeing to the anti-Semitic legislation being passed by the royal courts, because they didn't think it was going to affect everyone. But as you can see, they must have been well aware that there were Jewish refugees in the islands. Of course, none of these people had to declare their Jewish identity when arriving in the Channel Islands. So actually, the local authorities had absolutely no information about whether any of the refugees were Jewish, because the Brits didn't need to ask these questions. So what we see for Jews is increasing levels of restrictions on their lives. Any businesses they owned were sold, and eventually Jews were deported. So in April 1942, non-British Jews were deported from Guernsey. And in February 1943, a number of British Jews were deported as well to civilian internment camps. So the non-British Jews went to concentration camps. Of the five non-British Jews who were deported, three died in Auschwitz. One was in Buchenwald, and he survived, and one was in Ravensbrück, and she survived. So if we look at the political prisoners, the resistors, it was different events in the war that would trigger different acts of resistance. And the kind of resistance you see in the Channel Islands, we're not talking about an underground resistance movement. We are talking about individuals or very small groups who take it upon themselves to carry out certain acts. According to my calculations, I would say that around 220 people were deported to Nazi prisons, concentration camps, and labor camps, and between 1,000 and probably 1,500 people were imprisoned locally in local Channel Island prisons for acts of resistance.
Gilly, you fought hard to bring some wartime papers into the public domain and save them from being destroyed. Can you tell us what those papers were and why it was so important that they were saved?
The story, I suppose, goes back to 2010, when I was given an archive of a former resistor in the Channel Islands. And I learned through that archive that he had been very active in helping other Channel Islanders get compensation for being victims of Nazi persecution. And this showed me, this led me down the path of discovering that in the 1960s, there was a compensation claim opportunity for British victims of Nazi persecution throughout the United Kingdom to get compensation if they had been in a concentration camp or similar place of incarceration. That was the wording of it. And you could get compensation for both your time in a camp and for the degree of permanent disability. Those are the two categories that were compensated for. So I discovered that Channel Islanders were actually one group out of 4,000 people who applied for compensation. So other people from the British Isles who could legitimately claim to be victims of Nazi persecution might have been Brits who signed up to fight in the resistance in France and were caught and put in concentration camps, or perhaps prisoners of war who had escaped from their prisoner of war camps, being captured and put in a concentration camp. And also there were people who came to Britain as refugees after the war. So Polish Jews, Ukrainian Jews, for example, who got British citizenship in the 50s. And so were British citizens eligible to get compensation from the 1964 compensation agreement with the German government? So when I had discovered the existence of these 4,000 files, of which I think only about 100 were from the Channel Islands, when I discovered where they are, how many there were, what these were all about, I was told by the person who had guardianship of these papers, so they were in a closed government archive. I was told that because nobody had shown any interest in them for 50 years, they were due to be shredded.
Oh my goodness.
I know. I just thought to myself, are you kidding me? We have a collection of 4,000 testimonies of British citizens who were victims of Nazi persecution, an amazing archive, an invaluable archive of this experience of Brits, because when people think about victims of Nazi persecution, they do not think of British people, because mainland Britain was not occupied. You know, I was speechless. And so I petitioned the Foreign Office to release these files to the National Archives, and it took 4 years of weekly phone calls. I'm not going to say I harassed them, but it weekly phone calls. And eventually, after 4 years, these files were released to the National Archives. And so anyone today can consult them. It's a fabulous resource. Some people wrote detailed testimonies about their experiences in camps, because this is the first time they had an opportunity to write something and everything came pouring out. And some people wrote I was in Buchenwald and we all know what happened there, and said nothing more. So there's everything in between those two extremes.
Gilly, your perseverance and determination is absolutely remarkable. Which story of survival really stands out to you? Which I realise is in some ways an impossible question.
You know, Rachel, I mean, because every single account I read, I am sort of blown away by what experiences people had during the Second World War that we just have not experienced today. So many accounts I've read and I've thought that would be an amazing film. And I would be so hard pushed to name one, but I'm going to just sort of pluck one out of the air without offending any friends in the Channel Islands whose story I'm not picking. But I'm going to pick the story of Joseph Gillingham. And Joseph was from Guernsey, and he and his wife worked on an underground newsletter called the Guernsey Underground News Service, or GUNS for short. And the radios were prohibited in the Channel Islands from June 1942 onwards. The Germans called in, confiscated all radios, but some people kept a hidden radio. And the sentence, if you were caught, was to be sent to a concentration camp. Joseph, his wife, and a small group of just sort of five other people were involved in GUNS, and they were informed upon. Joseph's wife, Henrietta, was her role was covered up by her husband. And so he and four other men, they were court-martialed by the Germans and deported. And they initially went to Frankfurt and Naumburg prison, but some of the other men were taken away to labor camps. And at the end of their sentence, Joseph Gillingham was told he was going to be sent to a civilian internment camp of Laufen, which is near Salzburg. And he said goodbye to his other friends from Guernsey. And this was early 1945. And although those who survived this prison, I should say, were absolutely close to death at the point at which they were liberated, Joseph Gillingham was never heard of again. He did not arrive at a civilian internment camp. One of his colleagues was sent on a series of hard labor camps and just about survived with his life. Joseph was never heard of again. And his daughter, who had been born shortly before he was deported, grew up without her father and grew up with the grief of her mother and her grandparents. And when I first met Jean, his daughter, I thought to myself, I would love to help her. I would love to one day help her find her father. And this is a story which sort of always brings me close to tears, because I tried to follow so many leads. You know, I tried for years, and I sort of thought, I don't ever want to give up on her. I don't ever want to give up on finding Joseph. You know, what happened to him? There must be something in the archives somewhere. And there was a woman in Jersey whose father had been to the same prisons as Joseph, and for the same resistance offence. He also had worked on an underground newsletter in Jersey. And I contacted the BBC and I said, it would make such a fantastic documentary to go on the journey of these two men from Guernsey and Jersey, who actually were both called Joseph. The other one was Joseph Tierney. And they were in the same prisons and they knew each other. And Joseph Tierney didn't survive either. And his daughters had grown up with a very similar story of grief and not having a father. And I wanted these two women to meet each other and to share stories and for us to trace their father's footsteps. And I, a few months before the documentary took place, I had actually found the last resting place of Joseph Tierney. Sadly, his body had been dumped in a mass grave in a little village in the Czech Republic. He was on a train and a cattle truck on the way to Terezin concentration camp. So 4 days before we were due to fly to the Czech Republic and Germany to start filming, I had sent out emails to archivists in Germany, because not everything is on the internet. People think that everything is online these days. But having sort of looked at the roots of other people who were with Joseph Gillingham and seen where they went, I saw they were all within a 50-kilometer radius of Naumburg prison. And so I emailed all the archivists in that part of Germany saying, do you have any records about this man? I got a phone call from an archivist saying, yes, we have Joseph Gillingham's body in Halle. And I could not believe it, because I had searched for so long. And I know that Jean's mother and her grandparents had searched for years to find Joseph Gillingham's body. And I burst into tears. And we went to Halle, and Jean had her daughter Amanda with her. And we put in front of her, of course, I haven't seen this document either, but we put in front of her the document, which showed that Joseph Gillingham had actually died in Halle prison. We had no record. I hadn't known. And believe me, I had looked that he had been in Halle prison. And it was actually the anniversary of his death that day, completely coincidentally. And we saw this document and we all just burst into tears. And the whole week was spent crying heavily every day. So, you know, the film was all with us with puffy pink eyes and bloated faces and the tears and coat pockets full of very soggy handkerchiefs. And then the archivist said, you know, we can take it away. It's buried. And through some fluke, Joseph Gillingham's name had been recorded with the German spelling. And therefore, he was in the records as being German. And this meant that he got a grave as opposed to being dumped in a mass grave with other prisoners. So just some crazy fluke from 1945. So he, although he was cremated, he had a headstone. And we were, although it was spelt incorrectly, but we were able to take Jean to the grave of her father. And you can imagine the tears from all of us, and that included the TV crew as well. It was so emotional, I can't tell you. And it was so incredible to take both women to the graves of their fathers. The impact on both of those families, on having this family member restored. I know I phrase it like that because these people didn't survive. And so you can never reunite people with their loved ones, but this was the next best thing. And for both women, that journey of having visited the prisons where their fathers were and visited the places where their fathers' bodies were, they both spoke about it as getting to know their father for the first time, crazy as that might sound. And so when we started the journey, both women referred to these men not as daddy or father, but as Joe, because they had only known their father being spoken of with the name of Joe or Joseph. And they'd never kind of been able to entirely relate this unknown person to being a father. But by the end of the journey, they both felt that they had come to know their father and thought of them as daddy rather than Joe. And I can't tell you how deeply this affected me. Oh, and it always makes me cry to talk about it. But I think for the rest of my life, I sort of feel like it's the most important thing I've ever done, really. It really gets me every time, but it's such a powerful thing. And I'm so glad I was able to do it for these women.
What an incredible thing to have been involved in, Gillian. Thank you for sharing that with us.
I'm always passionate about sharing the stories from the Channel Islands because I think they're so often overlooked. And I think that sometimes people have no idea at all about what happened to those who stood up to the Nazi regime in the Channel Islands and those who were affected by it. So many unknown stories, but I've put all of them on a website. So if anyone wants to see original documents or read any of the multiple amazing stories, both of deported Jews or political prisoners, the website is named actually after one of those who was resisted, Frank Faller. It's called the Frank Faller Archive. So just type in Frank Faller Archive, all one word, frankfallerarchive.org to find the website.
Dr. Gillian Carr, thank you so much for joining us. As we continue to focus on other groups affected by Nazi persecution, we turn to the heart of the Third Reich and think about what it would have been like for those people to live in Germany during those years. Professor Eve Rosenhaft is a historian of modern Germany and professor of German historical studies at the University of Liverpool, and she joins me now. Eve, as well as the Jewish community, which groups living in Germany during the Nazi regime were most at risk from persecution?
Well, I think we should begin by reminding ourselves that the Nazi regime was one that carried out terror and brutal violence against everybody who was regarded as dangerous or hostile to the regime. And this included, of course, political enemies, faith groups like the Jehovah's Witnesses, and even common criminals. The prison regime under the Nazis was brutal and inhuman in a way that it never was in a democracy. But there were, of course, those groups that were targeted not for how they acted or how they talked, but for who they were. The Jews, of course, we recognize as the largest single group of victims of a genocidal policy. There were, of course, the disabled who were the first to be targeted for mass killing in the so-called euthanasia program. But there are two groups who, like the Jews, were labeled under the Nuremberg laws as being racially alien and therefore subject to controls on their lives and on their bodies, and to policies that were designed essentially to wipe them out as a group. And those were the Sinti and Roma, or Gypsies in the Zigeuner in Nazi speak, of whom there were about 30,000 in Germany and Austria in the 1930s. And people of color, Black people and their mixed race children. Both of these groups were defined as alien and subject to special measures.
Could you tell us a little bit more about those special measures, about the controls and the policies that were in place?
Yes. Yeah, so in both cases, again, under the interpretation of the Nuremberg laws that was already there in 1935, both Blacks and Sinti and Roma were denied the right to marry Aryans, and they were both subject to sterilization programs of different kinds. The Sinti and Roma were more systematically and consistently targeted, not only for sterilization, but for internment and, in the end, mass murder. The Sinti and Roma were interned as early as 1935. They were the first group for whom special camps were created. And those camps, significantly, when we come to think about what happened after the war, those camps were not set up by the Nazi government, but by local governments as a way of clearing them out, of getting them out of to the margins of respectable society. From being interned in 1935, Sinti and Roma were denied the right to carry on their traditional trades, or indeed to choose the kind of work that they would do. And so they were subject to forced labor on low wages. Their welfare benefits were reduced, again, very much in parallel with Jews. They were excluded from schools. And in the mid-1930s, 1937-38, they were targeted by programs that aimed at the work shy, and several hundred of them, men, were sent to concentration camps. Many of those men remained in concentration camps for 7 or 8 years, and they were dragged from one camp to another. Their labor was exploited. Their bodies were exploited in medical experiments. In 1939, Sinti and Roma were denied the right to move from their places of residence. Essentially, they were locked down. In 1940, the first groups were deported from the western parts of Germany to Poland, to labor camps. And at the end of 1942, Heinrich Himmler decreed that all gypsies, and I always use that term in inverted commas, should be sent to Auschwitz. The Sinti and Roma of Germany, Austria, the occupied Czech territories, and occupied Netherlands and Belgium were shipped to Auschwitz, where they were held in a special camp, the so-called Gypsy Family Camp. They were held as whole families. Many observers, including other prisoners, thought was a privilege for those who survived that camp. It was thought of as a particular horror because they were then able to watch their other family members suffer and die. And they died mainly of disease, overwork, and the violence of the guards. That camp was liquidated, closed down at the beginning of August 1944, after about 3,000 of the inmates had been sent back to Germany as slave laborers to concentration camps there. And on the night when it was closed down, some 4,000 remaining inmates were gassed. So that's, as it were, the deadly trajectory of policy towards the Sinti and Roma. In the course of that, they suffered other kinds of humiliations. Himmler had decreed as early as 1938 that the problem of the gypsies should be solved on the basis of their race, and supported a program that was already ongoing to identify the racial character, the degree of gypsiness of every Sinto or Rom in Germany. And that was a program of calling them in for blood tests, to have the color of their hair checked, the color of their eyes, to have their family histories traced. That was in itself a form of brutalization. That's, broadly speaking, the trajectory suffered by Germany's Sinti and Roma.
And what kind of treatment could people of color expect to face if they were living in Nazi Germany?
In the case of people of color, the trajectory was not so direct, and it was fortunately not so destructive. For complicated reasons, there were relatively few of them. They were a relatively new population. And for example, the Nazis had an interest for a while in keeping people who were colonial migrants on the side of the regime in order to take part in propaganda, which the Nazis were carrying on in the hopes that Germany would recover its African colonies. But the basic pattern of policy was similar. Young Black people were excluded from schools. They were not able to carry on professional training. Again, they were subject to forced labor, very often treated as foreign laborers because very few of them had German citizenship. Sterilization, I think, is the main reality and the main threat that the survivors remember. And we need to recall there that a significant group among Black Germans and Germans of color in the 1930s was several hundred born to German mothers whose fathers were French soldiers from the French colonies who had occupied the Rhineland at the end of the First World War. These so-called Rhineland mongrels were sterilized by force as a group in 1937. Other people of color very rapidly, I think, learned that they were going to be or might be targeted for sterilization. And in that sense, even short of mass murder, we can see that the way that the Nazi regime treated Black people, as well as the way it treated Sinti and Roma, was deliberately genocidal. The intention was that there should not be a new generation of Black Germans.
So these people were presumably living under constant threat?
The result, of course, of knowing that they were under threat was that they fled, they resisted, and that sometimes meant that they ended up in prison and concentration camps. There's no mass internment of Black people, but there's evidence from what happened to individuals, particularly during the war, that had Germany won the war, they would have treated Black people in the same way as they had treated Jews and Sinti and Roma.
Can you tell us how exactly they were able to do all of this in plain sight of the rest of the population?
In both cases, I think we have to see policy of the Nazis as very much in continuity with the kinds of everyday racism that had existed in Germany before the war. This is particularly true of Sinti and Roma, who had been discriminated against since they arrived in the German lands in the 15th century. For them, what had happened was that in the late 19th century, there was a kind of panic, particularly among the police authorities, that meant that from about the 1870s or 1880s, they were under constant surveillance. They were increasingly forced to carry identity papers that no other German was expected to carry. They were presumed to be criminal before they even did anything. They were seen by a substantial part of the German population, certainly as outsiders. So they were an ethnic minority. They had their own lifestyle. The economic activities were often, though not always, in the form of itinerant trading. So they were always, in some senses, outsiders or visitors in local communities. And the notion that they were criminal, dangerous, dirty, undesirable was very well established at the point at which, as I say, it was the town councils after 1935 that said, great, this is our chance to get rid of them and to put them in camps where we choose to put them, not where they want to go. There's an easy answer in the case of Sinti and Roma. People knew that they were always being harassed by the police. And if people saw that they were disappearing, frankly, really, nobody cared.
And would this have been the same for Black people?
In the case of Black people, there were very few of them. None of what happened to them was happening en masse. It was a question of observing that your neighbor was having problems. Everybody was having problems. And there was also quite a strong strain of skin color racism in Germany, emerging in particular out of the period when Germany had colonies in Africa between 1880s and 1919. Reinforced actually by Germany's loss of the war and its colonies and the episode of the so-called Rhineland mongrels, which begins in the 1920s.
You said that the general German population, I think your words were, quite frankly, didn't really care. What happened at the end of the war when the German population saw the true extent of the Nazi horrors? How did they come to terms with what had happened around them?
Historians for a long time argued that the whole of the post-war period from 1945 on was a period when Germans simply suppressed what they knew of what had happened, and that in a sense, this strategic forgetting was the basis for them to get on with life and to build the new Germany. And in, you know, in a sense, the Wirtschaftswunder, the economic miracle, was a positive outcome of this forgetting. It's very clear now that particularly in the first years after the Second World War, people were conscious of the suffering of others within their society. The victim status, in the case of the people I'm talking about, of Sinti and Roma and of Black people, was acknowledged, for example, by local governments whose job it was to identify victims and to support them. And the evidence is that that first burst of relative openness to the claims of the victims then fades away in the course of Reconstruction, only to come back really after the 1970s. In the case of Sinti and Roma in particular, that willingness to acknowledge their victim status really didn't happen until the 1980s. And in fact, they found it difficult. Those very few survivors, and something like 75 to 80% of German Sinti and Roma perished. So reconstructing their families was terribly difficult. When they went home to their home locations, they usually found that the property had been destroyed, their houses, if they had them, had been occupied by Aryans, and they found it very difficult to reclaim them. They also found it difficult in succeeding years to claim compensation. The German courts argued until 1963 that their racial persecution had only begun with the Himmler order in 1942, that everything they had suffered before that and what had been suffered by those who were in concentration camps and never ended up in Auschwitz was their own fault. Essentially, their internment, their exploitation was justified by the fact that they were criminally workshy. 1963, this changed in legal terms, but it was still very difficult for them to get acknowledgement of their situation. And they continued and still continue to be possibly the most disadvantaged ethnic minority in Germany. It was only in the 1980s that the German government acknowledged that what had happened to them was a genocide. And in 1987, that the president of Germany apologized and declared that what they had suffered was equivalent to what the Jews had suffered. In the case of Black people, experiences were more varied and individual, but again, hardly anybody knew that as a group they'd been victims of the Nazis. They were often very late to claim compensation because they were a very small and now scattered community and no one told them compensation was available. And there was also the problem that at the end of the Second World War, as at the end of the First World War, there was a new generation of Black Germans, the children of mainly of American, African-American GIs, who were identified then publicly in public policy and in the media as a problem, and around whom then residual and active skin color racism crystallized. So that since 1945, and in spite of the growth of an Afro-German community, it's still widely believed by white Germans that there are no Black Germans. And we hear this time and again from Black people trying to make their way in German society.
And in your opinion, Eve, what kind of Germany do we have now? And perhaps more importantly, what will the Germany of tomorrow look like?
Well, I'm afraid I've painted a kind of dark picture of continuing discrimination and racism. It's fair to say that German politicians and arms of the German state are acknowledging these issues. The Bundestag, just within the last year, instituted a commission to examine the situation of Sinti and Roma in German society. And this is in the context of EU initiatives that have been going on for a long time, but have been gathering force. And I have to say that at EU level and at national level, none of this would have happened without the growth and tenacity of activism in the Romani community itself. And the Bundestag Commission looked very closely at the whole history of the treatment of Sinti and Roma and came up with some very positive suggestions for measures, positive measures to improve the situation in terms of education, but also housing, health, and so on. And increasingly, those Romani activists have been busy since the 1980s, are finding support and networks in the wider community. In the case of Afro-Germans, it's increasingly difficult to maintain the claim that there are no Black Germans. There are Black Germans in the media, in politics, in business. There have also been institutional moves, particularly to acknowledge Germany's colonial past. For example, the University of Hamburg and the city of Hamburg instituted a program to work on and make public and make something positive out of Hamburg's position as the capital of German colonialism, and not least of Germany's engagement in the slave trade in the 18th century. Things are, I think, moving forward, not least at the level of public conversations in which these former victim communities are taking an active role.
Many thanks to Professor Eve Rosenhaft. Her book, European Roma, Lives Beyond Stereotypes, is out in early 2022. My thanks to our guests, Dr. Jilly Carr, and of course, Professor Eve Rosenhaft. Please join me on the next episode, when we'll be hearing more from the people who have survived genocide, specifically those who suffered under the hands of the Khmer Rouge of Cambodia from 1975 to 1979.
This atrocity had changed my life into nightmare. It destroyed my future and my dreams, but it couldn't destroy my hope.
I moved on with my life. Here is my home. But to be honest, I am stuck between two worlds.
Until next time, goodbye for now. Learning from Genocide is produced by Amanda Redman and is brought to you by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust and Trafalgar Strategy. For more information on the stories that you've heard today and ways for you to be involved in what we do, please go to our website, hmd.org.uk.